Okay, the format for this meeting is a 10-minute speaker, our secretary's announcements, and a coffee and a snack break, and then our main speaker. Our first speaker for tonight is Carl.
Thanks, Nick. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carl.
High on my fear inventory list is fear of public speaking, and it's hard for me, but there it goes. When Nick came up and asked me to do this, it was about 10 minutes ago, and it's funny because I had talked to my I had dinner with my sponsor last week, and I hadn't been going to meetings lately. And he said, well, I want you to commit to 3 meetings a week, and I want you to offer your services anytime anybody asks. So when Nick asked me to do this, there was a part of me that was wanted to go right out that door, and, but I was stuck. So anyway, I was a periodic drinker. I used that as an excuse for an awful long time, the fact that I didn't drink all the time. I could go 6 months without drinking, and then I'd go on a bender. I'd go 3-4 days solid drinking. But I thought because I could go 6 months, 9 months, 2 weeks without drinking that that this proved that I was not an alcoholic. I was also a runner. I loved to run, and I could always run 5 miles, and that was another excuse I used. I said, hell, I can run. I'm physically healthy. I'm not a bum. And so it was real difficult for me to come to the realization that I had a problem with drinking. And I remember the first time I took a drink was when I was 14, and it was a quart of beer, and it was like magic. And I'm shy and, you know, kind of reserved person, and got a lot of fear of people. And I took that quart of beer, and all of a sudden I was charming, and I was funny, and I could relate to people real easily. And I thought, man, this is great. This is all I need. I can just spend the rest of my life, or anytime I'm in a social situation, I'll just get a little buzz on, and I'm smooth, and I'm nice, and people like me. And that's the way I looked at alcohol until I finally stopped. It was a solution. It was a magical thing for me. And I did that. I went through high school. Anytime there was a social situation, I'd get drunk. I didn't call it getting drunk. I called it getting a buzz on. The first trouble I had was I got kicked out of the high school prom for drunkenness. A lot of stuff like that. A lot of trouble with the cops, and I never had a DUI until after I was out of college. But I was driving all the time, drunk. It's a miracle that I didn't kill somebody or myself. I remember the first time I had somebody tell me that I was an alcoholic. It was shocking. I was 16 years old, and we had a family psychiatrist. Everybody in our family went to the shrink. You know, you had a problem, you went to the shrink. And I got in trouble several weekends in a row in school, and I went to the shrink, and the shrink looked right in my eyes, and he said, I'm a psychiatrist. I can't help you with this. You're an alcoholic. You need to go to AA. And that was the first time I'd ever heard anybody say that to me. And I said, AA, you know, that's a bunch of old people thumping Bibles and, you know, talking about how awful it is to get drunk. And I'm 16 years old. I'm not going to go to AA. So that was the first time I heard it. I knew I had a problem because I just got in so much trouble that I just knew. My reason told me there was something not quite right. I just thought I was a problem drinker, and I needed to manage it. You know, that's why I was so happy when light beer came out. I thought, man, I can manage this with this light beer. Because I was a beer drinker. I loved to constantly pour it down, and I couldn't drink hard stuff. Anytime I drank hard stuff, I ended up with serious trouble. I remember one time I was at a Halloween party in Torrance, and I was drinking vodka like beer, and I was having a great time. I was dancing. Last thing I remember, I was dancing, and making people laugh. And then the next thing I remember, I woke up in downtown Los Angeles in an alleyway, blood all over my face, and a cop standing over me. And I don't know how I got there. I don't know what happened. Apparently, I got robbed. You know, my wallet was gone. I didn't know where the car was. The guy took me to jail. And that tends to scare you. You know, that scared me. So I went back to the shrink, and he says, go to AA. And I still didn't go. I was in the Peace Corps. I went down to Chile and spent 2 years drunk in Chile. And I trained to work on a farm in Chile, but when I got down there, some guy walked up to me and says, I want you to work in a government office in the capital city of Santiago. And for a drunk, that's great, you know, because there's nightclubs and bars, and Chile has great wine and good beer. They got a big German population down there. And so I spent 2 years in the Peace Corps helping the bartenders, you know. I got in real trouble. There was on my way home, I was hitchhiking and taking buses, and I was in Montevideo, Uruguay. And it's a port town, and it was filled, the bar section in the port town, with all the prostitutes and the bars. And I went down there and stayed drunk for about 2 weeks. Every day I was drinking, and I saw it as my Jack London thing. You know, I was talking to sailors from Russia and all over the world. And I thought, man, this is really great. This is a romantic. I got notes for my novel here, you know. And the thing that scared me is that I realized I really like this. I love being drunk every day and having a good time. And I was getting up at 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd get down to the bars and stay drunk and just keep doing that day after day after day. And the thing that scared me is that I like this. And again, there was a little voice in there saying, something's not quite right here. And things like this kept going on. And finally, I was going to another shrink. This is a different one. I was 44. See, from the time I first was told I was an alcoholic, 16, I didn't get sober until I was 44. And all that time, I knew there was something wrong, and I had to do something about it. And I tried everything. I did all kinds of stuff. But, I tried religion. I tried physical exercise. I tried yoga. I tried therapy, individual therapy and group therapy, and all of it. And none of it worked. And I was out of it. You know, I ran out of solutions. I even tried Anabuse. I took Anabuse for a year. I thought that was a solution for a while. I was sober for about a year. And then I started drinking through it. You know, you take the pill and start drinking and get the reaction. And I wanted to get drunk so bad I didn't care. I just kept going, which is a little dangerous. But finally, this female shrink, I'd been seeing her about 6 months, and she was urging me to go to AA. And I started art classes, and it was the first time I had seen something that I really liked. In terms of a career, I didn't have a career until that point. This was I was about 42 this time, 43, and so I was taking these art classes and enjoying it and doing quite well. And then I started getting drunk, going to the classes. They'd take a break, and I'd go down to the bar and get a beer, and then it was two beers, and then pretty soon I was coming to the class with a buzz on. And I realized I was endangering something I really wanted. So AA started creeping into my mind. And then this shrink, this female shrink, she's very mild-mannered, very touchy-feely, you know, kind of thing you want in a therapist. And she looked at me one day and she said, you fucking asshole, go to AA, you know. It shocked me, you know, really shocked me. And so I did. I went the next day. I went to an AA meeting, I walked in this AA meeting, and this guy walked up to me, and he stuck out his hand and said, "Hi, my name's Herb, and what's your name? And there was something about this guy. He was just real, he had this healthy look about him, you know, that a lot of people in AA have this kind of a healthy feeling to them. And I think within one meeting, I knew I was in the right place. And I was one of those lucky people. As soon as, I'd say within the first week, I lost the desire to drink, I never drank again. And I know some people spend a lot of time struggling with it, but I was one of the fortunate ones that just fell away from me. And I haven't had a serious temptation to drink. I've been sober 10 years now. And this guy became my sponsor and a terrific person. Started working the steps, and it's been a life-changing experience for me. It really has. And I have trouble with the concept of God. I'm still struggling with it. You know, it's been 10 years, and I'm going through the steps again now. I'm on the 8th step. And the God concept is real hard for me. And I go in and out of periods of feeling like I've got it. But, I still don't think I've really gotten it, like some people I see around in these meetings. But hopefully, if you're lucky like I am, you can stay sober even though you're struggling with this idea of God. And work the steps, clean up your life, watch things get better. And it's one of the surprising things for me about AA was the fact that there's laughter in meetings. You know, I always thought of AA as this dour, serious place, and yet, gosh, there's a lot of fun in AA. And that was a relief to me, a tremendous relief. So anyway, I feel healthy and I feel good, and I'm glad I'm here, and thanks for letting me share.
Now our main speaker will share his experience and strength and hope with us. Please join me in welcoming Charlie C. from Burbank.
Hi, my name is Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. And before I sail down the canal of woe, I want to thank Mike for asking me to participate here. It's always an honor to be asked to participate in AA, and something I don't take lightly. I don't take it too seriously either, but it's probably best that way too. For those of you who are new, AA speakers are not professionals, and we don't get paid, and you'll understand exactly why in about 5 minutes. I'm an alcoholic, and that's my only issue. And I have other issues, I suppose. My sponsor keeps insisting that they're defects of character, which is really short-sighted of him, I think. But I go along with him because he's tall and he's really cranky. So that's that. I'm an alcoholic. I believe the fastest way down a flight of stairs is just relax. I never intended to be an alcoholic. I never intended to do anything that would ever get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think if you had mentioned those two words to me 20 years ago, I think I may have just hidden somewhere. That's just too appalling. Alcoholics Anonymous is really the last stop. We are truly, I heard a speaker refer, when I was new, refer to Alcoholics Anonymous members as the creme de la scum. I agree. We are the best of the worst. The thing about it is that we just keep getting better, and the others pretty much stay on the they seem to be on the treadmill of life, which is a little familiar. Anyway, I had a lot of potential once. I still have most of it. I think I chose not to spend it all in one big burst. I have to let it leak out little by little. I was going to be somebody. I was always a sensitive person and a really hypersensitive kid, and I was an only child. My father was a carpenter, and my mother was a humble virgin woman, and I was always struck with being overly perceptive. I don't know if anybody else in here has that ability to it's a really uncanny thing to be able to read, to hear the implied content of things.
Yeah.
And be grieved by it, and then walk away and just keep thinking about it and keep running it over and over again. What do they really mean? And I've been that way since I was about 6, I think. And my dad and my mother and father never had a whole lot of money, and that was not anybody's problem, really. They made sure that I had everything I needed. I had good parents. I had good teachers. I had a religious upbringing that I think was excellent. I had, if a little scary, but I was raised Catholic. It wasn't scary because they made it scary. It was scary because I have the ability to read the implied content in everything. I thought I'd left the Catholic Church with a huge resentment when I was 15 and realized that the resentment I carried for the next 15 or 18 years was the resentment of a 15-year-old toward an institution. I had to go back and see what that was all about, but... I had religious upbringing, and I believe that God existed someplace, and that I existed here, and that the goal of life was to get through life without pissing him off so much that I'd have to suffer an eternal damnation. But I was not about to involve him in my life because that was not for people like me. And the reason it wasn't for people like me is because I don't deserve that kind of stuff. And there's something different about me than there is about other people who can incorporate God into their daily living. And I couldn't do it. So I tried to guide my life according to the Charlie plan. And if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's where it got me. I didn't think... It really wasn't such a bad plan. I wish I'd told someone about it, but I just figured I knew what it was. I didn't have to get any kind of counsel on it, and I did all the. When I was 18 years old, I went to a party, which was an unusual circumstance because I'm not terribly interested in being around people, and there happened to be people at that particular party. And, I've lived my life with a series of contradictions that have always bothered me. One of them is having disdain for the entire human race on the one hand and then demanding its approval on the other hand. That creates torque, real profound torque. The other thing is that when I feel such a sense of loneliness that I just want to evaporate off the face of the earth, that I feel like there is no value in my life, that there's no hope and there's nowhere to go, the last thing I want to do is be around people. You know, when I feel lonely and feel like I desire the company of my fellows, I don't want to be around them. It's really odd, and it seems so inconsistent to me that it didn't make any sense. But I think given the kind of person I am as an alcoholic, it makes perfect sense because I still feel that way up to and including today. It didn't happen today, but it could have had the circumstances not been right. But my life was constantly my prism of perception, trying to make everything work the way I wanted it to, and unfortunately, it never did. I'm a great rebel. I just never told anybody about it. I rebel against everything. I grew up in the 60s, and we were supposed to be such a rebellious generation, and I rebelled inside. It goes back with I was rebellious, but if you rebel too loudly, people won't like you. So I give a lot of the cosmic... people would suggest things to me that I didn't approve of, and I would say, all right. And then I'd do it, but very slowly, just to show my displeasure. But I don't think I'm different than any other alcoholics. I'm sure there are people in here who actually did this to people, and you're the ones who did time. Same... I think you're a badass. You got caught. See, I always got around it. If you're here, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. when I was 18, I went to this party and somebody handed me a can of malt liquor and I drank it, and my whole life changed. I had a religious experience. I had a feeling inside that I had never had before. I had a feeling of being at one with everybody else at that party. I had a feeling like Paul was talking about, the Irish came out of me. I started, you know what I mean? That sense of charm and the sense, all of a sudden life became poetry. I don't know where that came from. I didn't read all the stuff I was supposed to read in high school, but when I got drunk, I certainly could recite poetry. I spoke in metaphors. I had a grand view of life. I was going to be just like Errol Flynn and Dylan Thomas and John Lennon all mixed into one, which was really going to be quite a hat trick for me, since it's kind of hard to pull all those people off when you look like Sherman in the Mr. Peabody cartoons. But, I was going to give it a ride anyway, and I felt, all of a sudden I felt attractive to women. I've always felt like a baked potato with legs. I always felt ugly, and I was all forever slouched over. And when I was at this party, I was 6'2" and 127 pounds of percolating testosterone. And I knew that if I had the right woman, that would be it. You know, that I don't know what it is, but you know when you get it, that you'll know what it is once you get it. And alcoholics, I believe, are the only people who understand pronouns with no antecedents. We know what it is. We know who she is. We know, especially when someone like me drinks, I know where there is. Because when I'm drinking, I'm not getting drunk either. I'm going there. I'm going right there where everything is just clicking on all eight cylinders and the world is going to be great. And I can feel hope and I can feel my potential filling itself up as I stand there. And I get this overwhelming satisfaction of a job well done without ever having to do a goddamn thing. Just, you know that feeling? You just feel like it's already been done. Everything is settled, and you're just accepting the kudos for it. And then the next morning, you realize what the hell happened to me, and that's what happened to me that night. I was there. I was right on the money. I remember just being the life of the party, and after. I wanted to stay there. You know, you can't stay there on one can of malt liquor. I realized that, too. And, but I felt the, you know, believe me, if you're new, I got to clarify this, too, that anything I tell you about my alcoholism today is the result of 15 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous and listening to alcoholics and doing the steps and doing all the stuff that it takes to realize what the hell happened to me, because at the time I had none of this awareness. All I knew is when I drank, I felt damn good about it. I felt great. I felt infinitely better drunk than I did sober. Although I wasn't drunk, I was there. You know where there is if you're an alcoholic. And I had to pay the rent to be there, too, and I had about another half gallon of malt liquor that night and wound up running alongside of my best friend's car while he drove, hanging onto the door handle and vomiting in the wind and laughing my ass off because I had been there. You know, who cares about this mortal coil when you've just been there? You know, and no one else. You know, I found out if you're relating and you've been there, too, and alcohol relieves you like it relieves me, the bad news is that it doesn't work for 95% of the human race that way. Most people drink it like my ex-wife did. Just, whew. I'm sorry. I better not have another one. I'm starting to lose control. Which always seemed funny to me when someone would say that, because that was the only time I felt like I was getting any control. I was out of control sober. I felt, you know, I'm probably the only person in the baby boom generation who didn't take acid in the 60s, but I realized later on that I don't need to induce psychosis. I'm an alcoholic. I just need to think a little while about the state of things, and I'm in deep trouble. I'm hallucinating like crazy, but you know, and I got into the publishing industry after a few years of drinking. I started drinking when I was 18. I I had gotten out of high school when I was 17 and went right into college and graduated at 30. And I met a woman. The alternative is just not my style. But I met this lady. I was, by this time, I'd gotten into the publishing industry. I was a receiving clerk at Santa Monica College Bookstore, and I was going to be a writer. I had a jacket that I bought at St. Martin's thrift store on Main Street in Santa Monica. It had elbow patches, and I got an Oxford shirt, and I was going to be a writer. You know, you get enough pens and enough Oxford shirts and a really cool notebook, and you are a writer. It was much more important for people to think of me as a writer than it was actually to have written something, you know. But I did my best, and I was at this bookstore, and I'd unload trucks all day, and by night I'd go down to the Ore House in Santa Monica and drink down there, and I'd take out my notebook and set it out and just start writing. You don't have to write much. Hoping that she would come along. You know, I'd find her again, capital H, her. And I'd get down there, and after all the stress of the day, I'd get about three glasses of Jack Daniels in me, which I love bourbon. I'd get about three glasses of Jack Daniels in me, and then I'd get there, you know. And once you get there, who the hell needs her, really? And I think we've been driving people to Al-Anon with that phenomenon for years. But I need somebody when I'm sober, but when I'm drinking, I'm sorry. Could you introduce yourself again? I don't know why you're offering suggestions to my life. I don't think we've met. Do you mind? I've been up here with the great thinkers of the world. You know, I've spent most of my life indoors. And so I met this lady at Santa Monica College Bookstore. She was a clerk. She was beautiful. She was. She had a trust fund. She was. Which was not the reason that I fell in love with her, but it didn't hurt. And I was selfish and self-centered, as people like me are often. And my motives were pure. I dressed them just so that they would be satisfactory, so I could kind of get right in there. And we went out on a date. And our second date, I went over to her house, and I've been drinking at the Holiday Inn in Santa Monica for about 4 hours before I went over to her house. And from the time that I walked in there to the time that I got to her house, I had solved the Kennedy assassination. And I got in a rear-end accident on the way to her house and rear-ended some guy and his girlfriend and ruined the front end of my old Volkswagen, which was just... I drove the same Volkswagen for 21 years, and it looked like I did. It looked like somebody just tried to slap a smile off its face. And, raccoon hunting headlights that aim straight up like this. And I went over to her house with the evidence of having solved the Kennedy assassination, and I've been drinking, and I said, give me a bourbon. I got to sit down with you and talk to you about this. And we sat down, and I went over all the paper. I had pictures and articles and stuff laid out on the table, you know, and I'd gotten completely obsessed with it just a little bit. And she didn't get it. She was missing the big picture that I've always had. And the next day she went to her therapist, and it seems to be theme night, and her therapist told her, run from this man. Do not see him again. Don't answer your door or answer your phone to him. And we moved in a month later together, I meant her no harm, really, and I didn't harm her, at least nothing you could see. And but boy, that just became such a difficult thing. We moved in together, then she said, then we got married the old-fashioned way. Well, are you going to marry me, or are we going to live together for another year? All right, let's get married. That was, I'm a romantic, incurable. And so we got married, and we moved to Manhattan Beach. We lived here for about 5 years. Only thing, I went to the beach about 4 times in 5 years in Manhattan Beach. I got as far as the Shellback Tavern. I don't know if it's still down there or not, but I got down there, and it just is, you know, you just hear the sirens calling, Charlie, it might be in here, whatever it happens to be tonight. And I'd wander in there and drink in there, and there was another place down in that place that used to be unincorporated that always... El Porto, thank you. And Or you drive by and you have to dodge the fights in your car. And, this is in the middle 70s, and there was a bar down there that I'd go hang out at. And then I realized that my drinking was interfering with my drive, or vice versa. I think my driving was interfering with my drinking, and so I started walking down there. And I would call Lisa to come pick me up from places. And I got a really dull drunk log, and I'm going to skip through it rather quickly. I drank, I slept in parks, I peed blood, I take trips to the emergency room on a semi-regular basis. I call friends to pick me up and take me to the hospital in the middle of the night. I don't pay my bills. I would prefer to drink than do anything else in my life. And I will construct elaborate fantasies about what life is going to be like tomorrow for the luxury of being able to drink tonight. And Lisa was very upset about the way I was drinking. We lived just within view of, I've never been to this church before, but we lived right up there on 19th Street and at the top of the hill. And I would sit out on the porch with a bottle of whiskey and turn up the music and sit out there and listen to music. And when she would come out and ask me questions like, did you mail those bills I gave you? I would light into her like crazy. I mean, how dare you interrupt? I'm trying to create now. Do you mind? I've had a long day. I don't need your crap. I don't need any of your incessant nagging. Back off. And I would try to find that one spot in her day where she was the most vulnerable, and then just drive a wedge into it and kind of wriggle it a little bit just to make her jump, just to make her hurt, and watch her just look shocked as she stepped back and then feel terrible guilt inside for having done it and shame, but not knowing, I didn't do it because I wanted to hurt her. I did it because I wanted her to get away from me. I don't want to be interrupted. And, you know, if you're drinking for any period of time, things start getting smaller. Everything starts getting smaller. And I believe, I'm one of those people, I get smaller and smaller apartments. The longer I drank, the smaller my apartments got, till I could finally get one where I could stand in the middle of the room and lay flat palms against all four walls, you know, just like this in this place, because it gave me a little sense of control in a place. And that's why I think alcoholics do time so well. You know, we've got, I'm not trying to joke. I mean, when we get a little control over a little bit of space, it's some sense of power, because when I get outside of that perimeter, I've got no power at all anymore. And it just, everything starts walling up around, you know, things become frightening again. And I get angry and I react to it and I get hateful and vengeful and bitter and cynical and jaundiced about everything in life. And I can't even make a decent statement to somebody without being critical of something. And I became exactly the person I was, with all the fears and all the disappointment about living and all of the failed attempts at because they were half attempts at trying to get something going in my life, with all of the lost promise. I had all that going against me, which was the same thing that I had before I started drinking, except I was stone drunk, and I felt the same way. Alcohol had ceased to surprise and delight me like it did that first time that I drank at that party and felt everything was going to get better, and I got there. You know, by the time I finished drinking about 12 years later, I couldn't find there anymore except for little glimpses. You know, I'd pass it on the, I'd see the off ramp as I went by. That was there. God damn it, you know. But I gotta keep driving. You know, you just got to keep going until you find the next off-ramp. And who knows where that is. And oftentimes it was places where I would just choose not to be. And I would rather not have been there. It just so happened I was there. You know, what do you say when you come out of a blackout? Besides, which way is the door? When I was newly drinking, I thought blackouts were great. I thought they were about as close to molecular transport as I was likely to get. And, you know, one moment you're in a party in Long Beach holding your car keys, and the next second you're standing in your apartment in Santa Monica going, damn! Whoa! I am going to just sheer travel time off like that. It's going to be, this is living, like this. Then you wind up coming out of blackouts when you really didn't expect to. All of a sudden you show up and you've been doing something that you didn't know about up to that point. And then you're left explaining the actions of whoever it was you right before you got there. If you understand that, you were really, I'm glad you're here. I've come out of blackouts wedged between, you know, and I've heard all your stories. I've heard about coming out of blackouts, you know. I've heard you priests who come out of blackouts in a hot tub with three hookers. I've heard those. My hat is off to you in that respect. I've heard of people coming out of, I 12-stepped a guy one time who came out of a blackout with the SWAT team taking him out of his apartment. I thought, damn, this is great, you know. At least you know. I came out of blackouts at Chief Auto Parts store without a clue about how to fix a car, but I've got parts in the basket. I came out of a blackout at a dry cleaner's once in Santa Monica with a guy leaned across the counter saying, boxed or hangers, like he'd said it. I just appeared there, and there was this guy saying, "Bach." Yeah, it's really, unless you've had it happen, you know, like my ex-wife, if all of a sudden she just materialized somewhere and someone was saying boxed or hanger, she'd go, "Ah!" Not me. I just immediately say, "Hangers," and walk out and go, what did I mean? You know? I've heard all your badass stories, and I really like them. I just don't have... I came out of a blackout, as I was saying, wedged between a newsstand and a Carl's Jr. somehow with my car on the sidewalk, trying to... I just all of a sudden appeared there, and there are people looking out the window of this Carl's Jr. And it's just really disturbing. You know, you're looking at him going, I didn't do this. Somebody got me here. I'm just trying to get out. Now, would you mind just eating your damn whatever that goop is that you're eating and leave me alone? I get angry, and I don't get scared. I get rageful against anything that's like that. And my life just started unraveling, basically, in small degrees. Nothing really great or... No pinnacle of unravelment. It was all... It ended up at a Winchell's donut shop, you know, for God's sake. And my wife having divorced me, and I was... I'd racked up her credit cards. I'd racked up my credit cards. I'd racked up... I owed everybody. I owed Visa. I owed the IRS. I owed everybody. And I didn't know what to do. And I was drinking... I was living in my mother's house in Anaheim, California. She had gotten remarried and moved out, and I was living in this house... in one room of the house, remind you, just to keep that space. And I didn't know what was happening to me. And I'd been in therapy for 2 years. Fat lot of good it did me. I'm not a therapy basher, because the woman who treated me was a really qualified and competent and concerned lady who did everything she could according to her power to try to help somebody like me. But she wasn't getting the right information, because I didn't want her to not like me, so I wasn't going to tell her about my drinking. I wasn't going to tell her about what happened over the weekend. I'm going to tell her something. Well, I'm going to say that things were fine. I'm going to tell her about these other big issues, like the big picture of the world and how people don't treat each other right. And that, and then I'd stop just short of telling her that I was going out and shopping for guns on my lunch break. And then I'd never tell her that stuff, but I had been. I'd been saving food for Armageddon in my house. I was shopping for guns at the gun store in Santa Monica. Unfortunately, I had no credit cards that would even go through the register. And I wanted to have some protection. I wanted to protect, you know, I'm the perfect candidate for a gun, right? And which I guess is sort of okay now. But I just needed something in case old Marge across the street made a run on my canned food. I could probably pick her off. That's how I was thinking. I took to wearing a deerstalker hat and sunglasses at night, and having little episodes, you know. Like getting out of my car at 11 o'clock at night and having Marge stand across the street saying, "Hey, Charlie, what's with the hat?" I just like wearing it. I walk inside and slam the door and think, "What's with the hat? You're going to be wondering what's with the hat soon, aren't you?" Yeah. Yeah, when civilization starts coming down, you're not going to mind the hat, are you? When I'm keeping you on your property with my pistols, you're going to start wondering about the hat, aren't you? You know, and I go back out to my car to get something. He says, "Hi, how you doing? Fine, okay." Dead when this thing happened, and then go back in the house and feel ashamed. Like, what's happening to me? I need a drink, and then I drink again. I'd pass there on the off ramp, and I'd, you know, the same cycle, and go to work the next day. And I have this little stepping stone job. I was in my eighth year, and there, and it was a disaster. And I went to this meditation retreat, and I was going to kill myself there. I didn't plan it going up there. I mean, it would have been a lot cheaper to have just done it at home. But I went up there, and I was going to hang myself after this meditation retreat, because I realized that with the best help of people who really had my best interests at heart. I mean, this therapist had my best interests at heart. My family had my best interests at heart. My friends always had my best interests at heart. But little by little, I just became so pathetic to be around. Not in a big dramatic way, just one of those guys that after a while, the self-pity and the self-degrading and all that stuff and the drinking, people just stop coming over. They stop calling. They just aren't interested in hearing it anymore. And then I get to feel like a victim. They just cut me out. You know? My wife left me. Well, I battered her around enough verbally to make her feel like sludge, and then she leaves to protect herself, and I get to feel like a victim. You know, that's how it works with a guy like me. I shove you and shove you and shove you until you do something, then I get to be the victim and rationalize it all. I've got this elaborate architecture of rationalizations about everything in my life, and so I wound up at this retreat. I wanted to die. And to cut a long story short, at the moment that I felt like I wanted to die, I got a feeling inside that said, you are everything that you think you are, but I love you anyway. And I don't know where that came from. It wasn't me talking. And I just sat there and burst into tears. I didn't understand what was happening to me. Where did that feeling come from? Because I felt love right down into my soul, and I'd never felt such despair in my whole life 2 seconds before. And I felt loved for about five seconds, just a little glimpse of something. And then it went away. I don't understand. I can't rationally understand what that is. I believe that it was the intercession of a God who loves all of us, who loves all of his creations, who loves me as much as he loves anything else on this earth. And I don't believe alcoholics are chosen to be sober. I don't think that we are the chosen ones. I think that's nonsense. I think we're the lucky ones. I think most of us die. I don't suspect that God allowed me to live and let my brother-in-law drown because I'm a better person, because that's not true. I don't suppose God allowed me to live and let my best friend die of alcoholism because he thought I would have some hope in AA, but he won't, so I'll just kill his ass and let you live. I don't believe in a God like that. I don't believe in a God that treats us like little chess pieces and moves us around and puts, and then God put a check in my mailbox. I don't believe in the parking God or the unexpected check God or the $5 on the street God or any of the gods that you hear about a lot around here. I believe there's just an all-merciful and all-loving God who says, if you want me, you know where I am. And that's exactly what my sponsor told me when I got him. Except I could call my sponsor. Sometimes I don't know where to reach God. But I've got a sponsor who allows me to call him. And he has my best interests in mind, and he has no interest for himself in it. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I stopped drinking that day. That was the day I stopped drinking, was at that retreat. And my sobriety date is the 11th of June of 1981. And I have not had any alcohol or any drugs or any near beer, because I would choose to be not near sober. I'll tell you something. I sponsored a guy who wanted to drink near beer, and I'll tell you, for me, alcoholism is a life and death prospect, and I'm not about to go chippying around with something that's going to kill me eventually if I decide to take it one step further. I'm not going to play around with it. I mean, that's completely, in my eyes, disrespectful, the very thing that I've been given. It's like playing, taking a gift and throwing it in the trash can or compromising it, so I don't do that, you know. And that's what I've been taught around here. And it certainly hasn't hurt. But my life, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous because my sister-in-law brought me, and she brought me to my first meeting. I didn't want to be there. it looked like loser-rama to me. You know, I looked around the room and thought, oh, man, if I look like these people, I'd have quit, too. This is horrible. This looks like some really... Now, here I am. I'm standing in the back of the room in a tweed jacket with a wool sweater vest. It's as hot as it was today, with a deerstalker hat, sunglasses, shoulder-length hair, my John Lennon mustache, my jeans, which would barely support the extra 20 pounds of bloat I had, and a pair of boots leaned in the back of the room, and I was looking cool. And people kept trotting up saying, are you new? And I don't know. I was detoxing at the time. I detoxed for about a week and a half that I can remember. Actually, I'm sure I detoxed longer than that, but the worst of it was hearing the auditory hallucinations and crying at unexpected times, you know, like when someone asks you a question. And but I did have those gnats that get in your peripheral vision that just kind of appear and twirl here, and then you quickly turn to look at them, and they're gone. So you go back to talk who you're talking to, and back they come, and they're right there. And you're talking to people who are too polite to say, hey, you got gnats right up against your face there. And I didn't want them to think that I was just allowing the gnats to swirl around me, so I would stand going like this. So there I was at the back of my first meeting, standing in all my glory with sunglasses, deerstalker hat, tweed jacket, wool sweater vest, bloat, the whole sunglasses, going like this. And I got ticked off when people came up and said, are you new? I was encouraged to come back to AA. I don't know why they wanted me back. I suppose they were just looking for some quality people, because they certainly didn't have any where I was going. And looked like some sad people to me. And I still had an ember of potential. I could see that they'd all snuffed theirs out years ago. But once I got that ember fanned a little bit and stayed sober and heard how alcoholics learn how to drink, because that's what I thought AA was a place you'd go to find out how much toast to eat before you go out and that stuff. Once I did that, I was going to come back and I was going to go back out and be able to drink like a gentleman. And people had read it at the meeting I was at that if I did that, their hats were off to me. I thought that was really sporting. And that's how I interpreted my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I came back the following week because the woman who brought me to AA was taking a 30-day chip. Whoop-dee-doo was my attitude, but I went anyway. And I went there, and she took her chip, and then we all went out for coffee, and they all talked, and I sat there and, you know, got the last remnants of this. And then I went back the following week for a completely different reason, and that was that after 32 days, the lady who brought me to AA got drunk. And she 12-stepped me when she was 22 days sober. And I don't mean to make this sound overly dramatic, but that lady saved my life. This person with 22 days sober saved my life. She was my wife's sister-in-law, and she was a bad, bad alcoholic. And her husband had died of alcoholism, and I was next on the list, I suppose. And she saw what was happening to herself, and she allowed herself to be checked into a detox. And after she got out of there, I called her to find out how she was, and I had quit drinking about 3 days before, and she heard that. And she jumped right in with her 22 days and told me that there was a place I could go where there was some hope, basically. Just a place where people understand. You don't have to stay if you don't want to. Just come on by and take a look. They won't ask you your name or anything, or they won't ask you for your phone number. They just come in and see what's going on. So I went, and she saved me then. I mean, her words were comforting to me, and I sensed that she had hope. I didn't have any, but I was going to follow and see what she found. And I came back that third week. I'd only been going to one meeting a week, and I was getting a little skitsy in between meetings. And some guys, she had gone out that week, and I was devastated. I went back a little early to get a better seat that week. It was a 7:30 meeting. I got there at 4. And as luck would have it, and as I believe, and this is where people, I think, sometimes believe that God puts people in their lives, but I think sometimes if you just take action that you need to take, that the people have always been in my life. There have always been people in my life eager to help me. I don't believe there's any one of us in this room who can say they never had anybody who gave them a break or tried to help them. I just don't see it when it's happening. I can't recognize it because I'm so self-absorbed that when someone does try to help me with anything, it's not what I want. That's not it. I'll know it when I see it. Who would know better than me? And then I get to this AA meeting, and there are these two guys making coffee. And one had 10 years and one had 1 year. And they asked me what I was doing there, and I tried to mumble around that I was there to see some people who had been there last week, you know. And one guy said, "You mean the AA meeting?" And I thought, oh, man, enough already. There's a janitor right outside. If he hears it, it's like, come on, you know. I said, yeah, the AA meeting. And he said, well, we just came to drop the coffee pots off. We were going to go get some dinner, but we'll make the coffee now. Why don't you go set up the chairs, and then we'll go out and get a donut or something while the coffee's perking. I thought, okay. So I set up the chairs at the meeting, and that was my first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to do it. But if you're new here, I got news for you. Sincerity is no prerequisite for staying sober. The prerequisite for staying sober is just shut up and do it. And nobody really, you know, as much as we care and love you, we don't give a rat's ass about how you feel about anything. We know how you feel. Well, you don't have to tell us. They just told me to set up the chairs. I went and grudgingly set the chairs up. And I learned something that night, and that was that when I set the chairs up and we left for an hour and then we came back, people had moved some of the chairs. This is a fast group. Somebody moved some of the chairs, and I started thinking, excuse me? I think that if I had wanted the chairs right there, I think I may have put them there myself, you see, because I set the chairs up. And I got real possessive. And before I even realized it, I didn't even know it at the time, it had become my meeting that night, you know? And it doesn't matter whether it was based on a defect of character or not, it worked. I had taken the action, I had a reaction to it, and I came back the next week to make sure the chairs got set up correctly again. I showed up 3 times in a row, and they made me a greeter, you know, which is really a sorry statement for that group. But I, because what am I supposed to do? Say, hi, I'm glad you're here because this really sucks, you know. And it didn't come out exactly that way. I just said, glad you're here. Glad you're here. Not glad I'm here, but I'm glad you're here. I found something out in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this, you new people might want to know this, that life really does suck. It sucks when you're drinking, and it sucks when you're sober sometimes, but when you're sober, it's an infinitely better quality of suck. Stay. I got shipped off to another group. I was suggested that I go to another group in West Los Angeles because I wasn't going to do anything at this group. And I got a sponsor, and my sponsor started guiding me through the steps through his example. I wound up getting commitments at most of the meetings I was at. I went to meetings every night. He told me in no uncertain terms that my operative word in Alcoholics Anonymous is yes. And that anytime someone asks you something, to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, for Alcoholics Anonymous, your answer is yes. Before you ask when, where, why, how, it's yes. And then get the information. And if it conflicts with something else that you have planned that's a commitment, then you can tell them then. But your first response is yes. And I have not liked that. It's been damned inconvenient. Alcoholics Anonymous is inconvenient. Right off the bat, AA is a truly inconvenient way to live your life. And I find that my recovery and my well-being is, the quality of it is in direct relationship to how willing I am to be inconvenienced by AA. You know, and the people who stay in Alcoholics Anonymous are willing to be inconvenienced because most of the inconvenience comes in that first tradition that our common welfare should come first and then personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And that means, according to my sponsor, that AA doesn't need me, but I need it. And then I said, well, that's a contradiction because you said that AA needs its members. And he said, no. You need AA. It does not need you. But there are people in AA who are expecting you to show up and do what you said you would do. So you make the commitment to them to show up. And in doing so, you're helping out AA in some way and giving back something that you've gotten. Because I think people like me forget why I'm here. Sometimes I come to AA meetings to see what I can get out of an AA meeting. You know, just come in here and try to inhale the atmosphere and inhale some kind of recovery from people. And I found out that when I'm hurting the most, I'd have to do what those two guys did for me that saved my life, and that was find the sickest looking person in the room and go up and talk to them. Ask them how their day is. Get them a cup of coffee. Now, my sponsor suggested I do this, and I told him I haven't got anything new. I haven't got anything really wise to say to a newcomer. And he said, "You don't need to tell me that." And I don't think I asked you to say anything wise to him. I said, "Go work with a newcomer." And I said, "Well, what am I going to? How do I work with him?" And he said, "Get him a cup of coffee, or a half a cup. Get him." That's true. You'll only need to do it once, and you'll start getting them half cups after that. But I get them a cookie, get them a meeting directory, get them a big book. If they don't have the money, get it for them for free, and they'd had to do that with me. I owed everybody on earth, and I was into AA for $2. You know, I had three, it was five. I gave them the three, and they said, "Well, you can owe us." And I thought, oh, God, I have come to the bottom of the barrel now. I owe the Internal Revenue Service, Citibank, Visa, God, and now I owe Alcoholics Anonymous $2. I'm screwed. My life is over. And but he said, get them a big book, circle some meetings that you've gone to where you found something hopeful and some recovery, and make them feel as comfortable as people made you feel when you came to AA. And that's all you're responsible for doing right now until you learn something. And then you can tell them what you've learned. And only tell them what you've learned. Don't tell them what you've heard. And I thought, well, you know, but I did it, and he was right, and it just irked me that he was right. And I kept wanting to do the steps. I kept going up to Bill saying, "When are we going to do the steps? Everybody keeps talking about doing the steps, and I've been here around 3 months, and I haven't started doing the steps." He said, "I'll tell you tomorrow. I'll just see you tomorrow night at the meeting." So this is not what I want to hear. And he did this over and over and over again. I'd show up for my commitments. I'd call him every day. I'd, you know, do everything I was asked to do. But then I wanted to get into the steps, you know, because nowadays we're really into this. You hear that a lot. We just want to get into the steps. I don't want to just do the steps. I want to work the steps. I want you know, spot me. I'm doing three. Okay, here we go. We got groups of alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous. We got gurus and Alcoholics Anonymous coming out your yin-yang. We've got people who understand what Bill meant, if Bill had been half smart when he wrote that big book. We understand people who want to sit down with the big book and look up every word to find out what Bill meant by although. We've got people in AA who will do just about everything except throw chicken bones and feathers down and go woogie 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 over the big book. I'll tell you something. This program was started by a failed proctologist and a shiftless drunk stockbroker. If you want to know what surrender is, think about this. Alcoholics Anonymous was born the day that proctologist had to drink a beer to steady his hand to do an operation on somebody's butt. That's the person who gave everything to AA. That is the person I think about when I start thinking about Dr. Bob. I mean, Bob and Bill were men who had a phenomenal experience and shared it with people like me in their book, but I don't think they meant for us to be lighting the paper and inhaling it, trying to figure out what the hell they meant. It's pretty simple. There's nothing mystical about the big book. It's a plan of action, you know? And I kept insisting, when am I going to do the steps, till he got fed up and said, "Listen, how's this? You're 6 months sober. How many meetings have you been to? And I said, "Well, I go every night." "How many times do you call me?" I say, "Every day." He said, "How many times?" "Well, sometimes twice a day. You know, I call him all the time." "Do you do your commitments?" "Yes." "Do you want to do them all the time?" "Well, not really." "But you do it anyway, don't you?" "Well, yeah." "Why do you do that?" "Well, you're a grown man. Why do you show up to set up chairs in a meeting when you feel like there might be something on TV you could watch? You can just call somebody and say you can't make it then. Why do you do that?" "So because I always feel better if I just go ahead and do it." You know, that's all I could tell him. And he said, "Well, what makes you think you haven't done the first three steps? AA is not some Netherlands where we're talking in theory and abstractions about the steps. Ooh, you know, newcomers, we go up to newcomers and they say, I feel crazy, what am I supposed to do? And people smugly say, turn it over. How do you turn it over? How, where? And which end are you turning over? I needed to hear some real action, and that's exactly what I got, was people who said, get a commitment mop on the floor for a year and you'll feel better. And I thought, oh, easy for you to say. And then I did it for a year and I felt better, and I never even knew when it changed. I don't remember the night when I was mopping the floor and all of a sudden just, you know, had the big surrendergasm. There is no big you know, we get into all that stuff about phenomenon in AA, and we get so metaphysical and we get into all that bullshit. Alcoholics Anonymous is a series of practical steps for really lame-ass people like me. If it had been anything more, I couldn't have handled it. If it had been something like, explicate this passage from Shakespeare, I could have handled that. Instead, I got a book that has metaphors like the Jaywalker. It has great lines of literary merit like, gee, Ma, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing? And yet, that book saved my life because it allows me every single time I read it, which is repeatedly, to find some new action to take to put the steps into motion rather than just sitting around and jawing about the steps. Because if alcoholics were nothing more than people talking nice about the steps, we'd all be drunk. And I wound up, you know, I have to incorporate the program into my life the best way I can by doing, by doing the simplest things I can do. Using my turn signal when I change lanes in a car. It's inconvenient, but it's just a matter of surrender, you know. But people talk about surrender like it's some big high ground military action when it's nothing more than holding a door open for somebody. It's nothing more than recognizing the God in someone else by acknowledging them with a look in the eye and a hello, even though you don't know them and you might not even approve of them. Even if it's the guy pouring water at your table in the coffee shop, to acknowledge a human being is that ground level of way of trying to get out of myself and my own selfish interests. It's much more spiritual for me to signal my lane change and just let somebody know I'm coming over, or allow somebody else who wants to come over to get in the lane in front of me, than it is to come up here and talk about God for 20 minutes. It's more spiritual to pick up the telephone when it's ringing and answer it than to let the machine catch it because I'm watching ER and don't want to miss that pivotal plot point, you know, which is my nature. But, and I hate that because I always pick it up and it's always the same guy. She dumped me again. Now, does this woman ever dump you on, say, a Tuesday night? She always seems to be unloading your sorry ass right in the middle of ER, you know? When next time you're back together after your numerous reconciliations, why don't you sit down with her and say, before we get into one of these discussions, let's watch all of ER together. Then when she dumps you at the end, I'll probably just miss sports, you know, on the news. But I always pick up the phone anyway because it's more spiritual to me to just pick the phone up than it is to talk about God for 20 minutes, because there is no God if I'm not willing to do that stuff. God is action. God is not talk. And Alcoholics Anonymous is not a program of metaphysical analysis. It's not a self-help program. It's not therapy. It's not dating service. It's not a job networking place. It's a place where alcoholics like me get a chance to talk to alcoholics like you, and in sharing our sadnesses and our fears and our experiences and the way we screwed this program up royally trying to do it, that we gain some hope for tomorrow and come back again tomorrow night and do it again. And a day at a time, we start putting some time together. And a day at a time, we become less selfish. And a day at a time, by becoming less selfish, I'm able to open myself up to maybe allowing a little bit of God in there to do His work, whatever that may be. And it's usually not His hand itself. It's usually the hand of somebody else, like someone in this room. It's usually one of you who does it. It's not God. You know, I don't see the ceiling open up and see the big hand come down and anoint me with some observation. It's usually somebody in AA. I don't understand what God is either. I really understand when people say, I don't have a concept of God. That, great, it's the action. It's the struggle to get there. I heard a guy, there was a guy in my group who named Richard Hutton. Richard's dead now. Richard died sitting at a bus stop waiting to go to an AA meeting. And Richard was what could be termed mildly retarded. He had difficult speaking. He had a speech impediment. And he talked real, he had a real abrupt kind of way of talking. He had kind of hard a Litton to him. He had a Litton real closely when he talked to you. And Richard would, you wouldn't know that he even heard anything that was going on in a meeting. He would sit there and eat and mumble to himself. And one night it came around and we got into one of these, you know, it was one of the more esoteric meetings of AA where we're talking about God and everybody's just feel filled with wonder, you know, that moment where everybody feels like they're all connected. And but nobody could really nail it down. And it came around to Richard at the discussion meeting and everybody kind of rolled their eyes because here goes Richard, because he always wind up talking about World War II or something. And it came to Richard and he said, well, I God, a power greater than I am. And that's like my father. He was a power greater than I am. And then, but I figure somebody was a power greater than he was, so that was my grandfather. And then I go back to my grandfather and my grandmother, and somebody made them and was a greater power than they are, so that's my great-grandfather. And I think if you go back far enough, you'll find God. And everybody in the room went... So... here we are, you know, we hear God's message through everybody in AA, good example and bad, and it's not that hard, and you don't have to understand a damn thing about what's going on around here if you're new. I'll tell you the story and I'll sit down. This guy, when I was 10 years old, I still had not mastered riding a bicycle. It was one of those challenges that I was going to hold off until my teens, I thought, and I was scared is what I was, and I wanted to just get on the bike, pop a wheelie, and roar down the street. I didn't want to learn how to ride a bike, you know, but this fellow named Irv Goldstone, who lived about two doors down from me, came by one day and saw the bike in the garage and said, you want to learn to ride the bike? And I said, oh, okay, I thought. And so I went out and got on the bike, and he said, you pedal and steer, and I'll hang on to the back, and I won't let you fall down. How's that? And I said, okay. So I get on the bike, and I lock my elbows and lock my knees and start pedaling like this and steering. And I'm every 2 seconds glancing over to see if Irv is there. And he's walking along, holding on to the rack on the back, saying, you're doing fine. Keep going. You're fine. Just pedal and steer. I'm hanging on. We walked about two blocks and came back again. And I got in the house and toweled off because it had been an experience, you know. And the next day he came back. You know, I hear him at the door. And I came to the door and he said, you want to take the bike out again and practice again? And I thought, I didn't learn to ride it yesterday. What makes you think I'm going to go out and ride it again today? And I said, well, come on out. Get on, just pedal and steer like we did yesterday. I'll hang on to the back and we'll let you fall. Just go. I got on the bike again, locked elbows, locked my knees, and did it. We went about four blocks that day and came back. And again, it was a harrowing experience. I had to go in and lie down not tell anybody what was going on. But because if I did my typical thing, I would have stopped learning how to ride the bike, and then everybody would have known that I was trying. So I just didn't tell anybody I was learning to ride a bicycle. And then he came back the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And it was the same thing every time. Come on out. You get on and pedal and steer. I'll hang on to the back, and I'll walk with you, and I won't let you fall. Okay. So I get on the bike. Well, after about the third or fourth day, you know how we are. I get out there. I'm feeling kind of loose. You know, I get on the bike, and I start pedaling, you know, and steering. I look over. Irv's hanging on. I thought, I wonder what Irv's made out of today, you know? I started pedaling a little faster, you know, and a little bit faster and a little faster, and I'm going along and I'm thinking, damn, Irv, and I look over and he's gone. And I'm riding this bicycle down the middle of Victoria Avenue in Anaheim, and I look back over my shoulder and he's waving about two blocks back, and he'd not taught me to turn yet, so I was just... I'm pedaling that thing, and it's like turning a submarine around. You know, I have to go about 90 blocks around my neighborhood a little bit at a time just to get it going. And I rode that bike all the way around my entire neighborhood, and I came back that night, and I've never forgotten how to ride a bike since that day. You know? I've never forgotten. And at the time that I learned to ride that bicycle, I knew absolutely nothing about all the principles that are necessary to ride a bicycle. There has to be physics at work, inertia, momentum, all those principles have to be at work to ride a bicycle. There needs to be inner ear balance, levers, pulleys. There needs to be, the wheels have to be spoked just right for the wheel to roll, for the bicycle to work. The gears have to be aligned just right so when the wheels pedal, they connect with the wheel and turn it. All those principles must be in effect or that bicycle is not going to work. You can't ride a bicycle with any of those principles, with any one of them out of place. You can't ride it. And I didn't understand any of those principles when I rode that bike. All I knew was Irv said, you get on and pedal and steer, and I'll hang on to the back, and I won't let you fall. How's that? And so if you're new here tonight, my suggestion would be come back tomorrow night, just get on the bike again, and just start pedaling and steering. You don't have to understand what's going on around here. We'll hang on to the back. We're not going to let you fall. You continue to show up, continue to do what people ask of you here, and we will continue to hang on to the back of that bike, and we will not let you fall as long as you keep pedaling and steering. And someday, we're going to see that you're doing all right. We're going to let go of the bike. It's going to be our call, just like it was Irv's call. If it had been my call, he'd still be going with me down the boardwalk, you know. But it was his call, and it's going to be our call. And someday, we're going to see that you can do it, and you're going to be riding this program by yourself. And we don't want anything back from you except one thing, and that is that you come back the following night after you've learned how to ride this bike. You come back the following night, and you look around the room, and you find the person in the room who looks really sorry. And go up to that person and say, come here a second. Hop on the bike and pedal and steer. I'll hang on to the back. I won't let you fall. And thanks for being with me.